It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Well, today it's why they're slim and we're not. The they are the French. The why is not what you'd expect. Our guest is Barry Popkin, professor of global nutrition at the University of North Carolina and director of the university's Interdisciplinary Obesity Center. His book is The World is Fat. Sally Schneider of improv cooking fame talks A Cook's Arsenal, the great flavor enhancers. Korea's preserved cabbage, kimchi, showed up in your grocery. Well, now let's find out what to do with it. Then the tables are turned. I'm the one getting interviewed about pasta, what I learned at my nonna's knee. And as always in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's get started with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the road food column at Gourmet Magazine. Jane, Michael, I remember crumb cake as a kid. Do you guys ever run across this?
You remember crumb cake because you grew up in New Jersey. I grew up in Chicago, and I never heard of it until I came to New Jersey, and maybe a little bit New York, where crumb cake is huge. And the best place to get it is New Jersey at a place called the B&W Bakery. And this is a place in Hackensack where they make something called heavy crumb cake. And they aren't kidding when they say heavy crumb cake.
I love that name.
Because, well, first of all, the layer of crumbs on top, a kind of streusely, crunchy, sweet thing, is, I would say, 2 to 3 to maybe even 4 times the height of the cake down below. I mean, the cake is really just a crumb delivery mechanism.
But this is exactly what I remember. This is the understanding of real crumb.
Yeah, well, this is serious crumb cake, but I do believe that people from other parts of the country really don't know about it. When they think of crumb cake, they think of some, like, awful little coffee cake, you know, from the store. This is, like, serious crumb cake. The other reason they call it heavy crumb cake, by the way, at B&W is that when you ask for a piece, mm-hmm. I remember I went there and I said, may I have a piece? Maybe I'll get 2 pieces. So they cut a slice of it approximately 8 by 12 inches. And I said, no. They said, well, that is 1 piece. We'll give you another one. So 1 piece is enough for a family.
Yes, exactly.
And 2 pieces are enough for Jane and Michael.
Has this place been there for a long time?
I think over 60 years.
Yeah, it's been there forever, and it's the kind of place that, you know, there are long lines, especially on weekends, because nothing in the world goes better with a cup of coffee or several cups of coffee than this crumb cake.
You know, the one thing I have not seen in our travels is any sort of Nouvelle crumb cake. I think the B&W Bakery is really worth a trip out of your way. I mean, even if you're not within shouting distance of Hackensack, it's a good day trip.
Yep.
But there are 2 philosophies of crumb cake. And one is that the cake is like pound cake, and the other one is that the cake is almost like white bread. Which category do they fall in?
B&W is definitely in the pound cake category. Uh-huh. I mean, it's sweet. It's not overly sweet. And even if it were overly sweet, how would you know with that topping of streusel? I mean, it overwhelms anything down below it.
Well, it sounds like I should go and just get a slice.
A piece. For all of us.
A nice 12-inch slice.
Guys, thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of 2 for the Road. Now, you can hear the Sterns here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. I have to confess, I am so angry at myself. Last week, after vowing to cook with what was already in the house, I set out to reorganize the dry goods closet. Well, it turned out to be an exercise in shame. 2 bags of food had to be tossed because of being well beyond use-by dates or looking suspicious. two bags, the money, and the food shelves that could have been stocked with what I had to throw out. I mean, I know better. My excuse is the closet is very deep, but I know how to rotate stuff. You know, the oldest stuff goes in front and you organize things the way it's logical for you. You know, I joke about being the condiment queen, but the truth is I'm always picking up things to try, especially in ethnic stores. The problem is that within weeks they're shoved out of sight and they're forgotten, which is how I ended up with 4 packs of rice paper rounds for spring rolls. No more. It's cold turkey time. Nothing will be bought unless it is needed now. And to keep organized, I am sawing down cardboard boxes to fit the shelves. This way I can slide out the box and I can see everything I've got. And if any of this rings true for you, I'd be happy to loan you my box cutters. Cookbook author Sally Schneider was born to riff on recipes. She was a classically trained chef who started rethinking how to create flavor, looking at dishes from every angle to bring new tastes into play. Well, Sally Schneider is the author of The Improvisational Cook, and she comes by often. Sally, it's good to have you back.
Hi, Lynn. Good to be here.
Sally, we all come home and we're really harried. What do you do when you're in that state?
Lynn, I have over the years, because I'm kind of lazy, kind of busy at different times, come up with a battery of quick and easy flavor enhancers. They're simple things that I rely on to transform foods, give them not only flavor, but some element of surprise, but without much work. In fact, without any work, just adding them in.
So what kinds of things are you talking about?
For example, years ago when I was in France, I tasted an aromatic pepper mix that a friend of mine had in her kitchen, and I came home and kind of elaborated on it. It's a mix of black, white, and pink peppercorns, plus some allspice and coriander seeds. I mix up batches of that, and I have it to refill a pepper mill. And I use it when I'm in a bind. For example, the other night I was really tired. I had a cabbage. I made a slaw, just dressing it with olive oil and cider vinegar. And I ground on a good amount of this pepper mix. And what you get from it are little hits, for example, of pink peppercorn, which is kind of sweet. And you get the coriander, which is lemony. And it's not hot. It's just little bursts of flavor that totally made the dish. It was quite amazing. And it can go like pepper on anything. You don't want to use it on every dish. You want to use it on, say, one dish within the grouping of dishes for those quick surprises.
And cabbage would be a particularly good place to use it because it's really a neutral.
Right.
So some other thoughts.
So then one day I was doing a recipe with toasted crushed coriander. And I had made too much of it, and I had it left over, and it was in a little bowl on the counter. And I started to throw it on things. Again, what can I do here really easily? It's spectacular with any kind of potatoes. So one day I boiled some potatoes, crushed them coarsely, put on some sour cream chives, and the coriander. It was amazing.
Whoa.
See, it's crackly. It's not just the flavor, which is this kind of citrusy, slightly nutty flavor. Mm-hmm. It's great on fish. I've crusted tuna and swordfish with it and seared it in a pan. Wonderful in grain dishes because it provides a little texture with the grain, on smoked salmon, on and on and on, even in soups as a little tiny bit of something that you don't quite expect, say a bean soup.
Now you're talking about crushing the whole coriander seeds, not the already ground coriander.
Not the already ground. You're going to toast it in a skillet till it just becomes fragrant, put it in a mortar and crush it with a pestle, or just put it on the counter with a cloth over it and do it, crush it with the side of a chef's knife. So you get these, it's a coarse and crackly meal, really.
That sounds fabulous.
And Lynn, I've got one more. which it's chives. For me, the instant no-fuss onion flavor when I'm too lazy or hairy to chop an onion or a shallot. I keep them on hand when I go shopping. They last for about a week in the fridge. And all you have to do is snip them or slice them crosswise. A tiny bit, say, in a green salad makes the salad seem like it has much more depth.
Mm-hmm.
I make chive French toast. I throw them on steamed vegetables with olive oil or butter. Just about any starchy food loves them.
Yeah.
You get the idea.
Hey, Sally, thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Sally Schneider is author of The Improvisational Cook. Now, you can find Sally's recipe for salt-roasted new potatoes with creme fraiche and cracked coriander on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to also check out all of our other examples of vital, essential, life-changing information. Our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, our podcasts, recipes, and information on our book, How to Eat Supper. And also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Coming up, the real reason why the French are not fat, kimchi for every man and woman, and the pasta maneuvers. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. We're fat, they're not. Listen to most pundits, and you believe that obesity is ours, an all-American plague. But listen to certain researchers, and you get a different story. For instance, Barry Popkin claims obesity isn't an American problem, it's a 21st century human problem. Barry Popkin is the Carla Smith Chambly Distinguished Professor of Global Nutrition at the University of North Carolina. He's the director of the university's Interdisciplinary Obesity Center. Now, for several decades, he's done long-term studies in countries around the world. Much of this comes together in his book, The World is Fat: The Fads, Trends, Policies, and Products That Are Fattening the Human Race. Professor Popkin, welcome.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Barry, we know we Americans have a weight problem, but I'd like to talk about other areas of the world, particularly the French. I mean, what is with the French that they don't have a weight problem?
The French are really an interesting, unique situation. Beginning in the 1880s, French physicians were very concerned about overfeeding the babies. The French passed the National Public Health Act based on teaching mothers how to feed their infants, weighing and measuring everything they fed them so they didn't feed them too much. Then a larger movement called the puriculture movement started. Clinics were created in every community across the country to teach mothers how to weigh and measure not only what they fed infants, but school age and preschoolers. And it spread into the family. So there were no second servings. There were no snacks. Kids had to eat at a regular mealtime, and they had to consume certain modest portions. It was ritualized by government training of all women. Today, some of those portion controls are being relaxed. However, the government in France has funding in at least 100 different cities, very strong programs to regulate weight and activity and diet. And it's much more involved in people's lives than we could ever be in our country.
Let's talk about Mexico. You write about a family that comes from Mexico to the United States. And this seems to be a contrast to what we're talking about in France.
Certainly in Mexico in the 1950s to 80s, hunger and malnutrition was the problem, and there was no concern for overweight. However, Mexico today has as much overweight as the U.S. But now let's shift to these migrants. They came out of a hungry world to a world of food of plenty. They became U.S. citizens. They live in Los Angeles. And now the father has what he calls sugar in the urine. It's a Spanish term. Everybody in Mexico uses it. They use it in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And this diabetes that he has, he attributes to susto or shock. It's another term they have. It comes out of their folk medicine when people got this disease, but they didn't know the cause of it. And today, of course, we now know it's called diabetes and it's caused by obesity and inactivity. But around the world, people weren't treated 40, 50 years ago. And even today, two-thirds of Americans don't really control their diabetes. And in Mexico, nine-tenths of the people with diabetes don't even know they have it.
One thing that you talk about that I found really surprising is the love of sugar. It seems that for this family, and perhaps in Mexico as well, the adding of sugar to a soft drink, the use of sugar in extremes, is almost as though it's a sign of achievement or a sign of well-being.
Well, I don't know why they do it, but Mexicans doubled in 7 years from 1999 to 2006 across all age groups the amount of sugar in their beverages. They add it to juice. They add it to everything. Even a preschooler in Mexico consumes over 20% of his or her calories from caloric beverages. Mexicans in the U.S. also consume a lot of fruit juice. They sweeten it. They consume a lot of soft drinks. And it is indeed one of the problems and one of the causes of diabetes in both countries.
And no idea why the sudden, you know, over 7 years, it seems so dramatic.
Well, it became available. It became marketed, and they got more income. All the above happened at the same time. This is not unique to Mexico. Even in the U.S., we added 21 ounces per person in the amount of caloric beverages we consumed between the 90s and the 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
We, today, the average American consumes 460 calories of beverages. The average Mexican does the same. It's the same marketing, the same promotion.
Yeah.
It's just that it all hit Mexico quickly just in the 90s.
Is the Mexican government doing anything about this?
Yes. I was part of a beverage panel under the Minister of Health. Today, the Mexican government is getting soft drinks and even whole milk out of the schools. Water and skim milk is what they're going to provide. They are pushing very hard to limit the amount of caloric beverages consumed by all age groups.
Your work has taken you over much of the planet, and you have a statistic in the book. You say, on the entire planet, 700 million people are undernourished, but 1.6 billion people are overweight. Where is this coming from?
A lot of it is coming from our country. It's not coming because we've pushed McDonald's on the world. It certainly has something to do with caloric beverages like Coke and Pepsi.
Mm-hmm.
But our agricultural system is partly to blame. What we essentially did was design an agricultural system from the turn of the century, 1900 to the present, but particularly after World War II, that focused on creating cheap beef, pork, poultry products and dairy products. As a result, we had a system that we then gave through development and education and promotion to all of the developing world. And it's come back to haunt us. The globe, it's so cheap to buy oil, it is so cheap to buy beef compared to what it was 30 years ago that everybody's buying it and everybody's increasing the kind of vegetable oils in their food and increasing the beef and pork and poultry that they consume. So what we did was we took away the healthier parts of people's diet. Mexicans, rice and beans, was a very healthy diet with some tortillas. In Central America, the same. What are they consuming today? They're throwing a lot more oil in. They're consuming a lot more beef. They are consuming a lot more Coke and Pepsi and so forth. We did it to them, but not in the direct way of telling them this is how you have to eat, but in having them adopt the agricultural system that we designed that was so successful for us at producing cheap food products.
Mm-hmm. And all with the best intentions.
Yes, absolutely correct. It's kind of a best intentions from our goals in the 50s, which were protein was what was important, and people should drink more milk, should eat more beef. Only later did we learn that from a health perspective, we should have created a different system, but that system is self-perpetuating around the world today.
Barry, thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Lynn. Thank you very much.
Professor Barry Popkin is the author of The World is Fat. Food is in the introduction stage here in the United States, and it's about time. Who could resist something called bibimbap? Deborah Samuels, co-author of The Korean Table, From Barbecue to Bibimbap, joins us today. Deborah, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn.
So, Deborah, this food boom in Asia, mm-hmm. this great interest in Korean food, how did it start?
Well, there was a fantastic TV series in Korea, in South Korea, in English called The Jewel in the Palace, and in Korean, Daejeongeum.
Uh-huh.
And it's all about imperial court cuisine in the 1550s. 54 episodes of intrigue, how the court ladies were vying for top position as highest court lady in the kitchen, and it's a love story as well. But the food scenes are magnificent and were meticulously researched and done by women who actually teach imperial court cuisine now. And it became a wild hit throughout Asia, spawning all sorts of new Korean restaurants. And some of the restaurants have the name of Daejeongeum.
Huh.
And one thing that I noticed while watching this series, and sort of is very telling of the way, you know, Koreans and Asians, I think about food,
uh-huh.
is there is no gluttony involved. When you think of courts in England and Europe and people getting, you know, diseases of excess, this is really the polar opposite of it. The mixtures of food and seasonings and things are mm-hmm. all looked at how the Koreans view food as medicine. And I found this quite fascinating.
Can you give me an idea of what imperial food was like?
Well, interestingly enough, it wasn't spicy. And I think most people think of Korean food as very, very spicy because that's what it is now.
Uh-huh.
But the hot pepper did not get to Korea until sometime in the 1600s. So prior to that, the food was very, very vegetable heavy. A very little amount of meat was used. And when it was seasoned and spread out among many, many dishes. The combinations, I think, were very interesting. There are sea vegetables, there are land vegetables, there are lots of fermented vegetables that are used in Korean cuisine. And fermented food is a very large part of this cuisine and thought to be very, very good for your gut and your digestion.
Now, kimchi is the national dish of Korea, and I think for we non-Koreans, it's what we identify most with Korea. But is this fermented cabbage? Is that what it is?
Well, kimchi is actually fermented vegetables, and there are over 200 varieties of kimchi. And the kimchi is served seasonally. There's different kimchi for the winter and for the summer because they take different amounts of time in the fermentation. But any vegetable almost can be made into kimchi. The one we're most familiar with is made with the Napa cabbage.
Right.
And it is salted to remove the water and uh-huh. pressed. and then seasoned with red pepper paste and aromatics like ginger and garlic. And what helps along with the fermentation process is some kind of anchovy or shrimp paste, which is where you might get that smell that Americans or, you know, Westerners are not that used to.
So is it now I've heard that you have to bury it for a long period of time. We're skipping that step, I gather.
We're skipping that step. Most Koreans don't live in rural areas or places where they can bury their clay pots to winter over the kimchi. But there is a new phenomenon, and it's a kimchi refrigerator.
Really?
Yes. We don't need a kimchi refrigerator here, but very often because Koreans will make or have a large variety of kimchi, they'll have a separate refrigerator that keeps it at a certain temperature, kind of like a wine refrigerator.
So now, how do you use the kimchi?
Well, kimchi, we might think of it as a pickle, as a side dish.
Mm-hmm.
And you can wrap it around steamed white rice. You can add little bits of it to a food that you're eating. You can add it to stews, and you get a wonderful fragrant stew with a big kick to it. And very often it's used with pork and tofu and makes a wonderful addition. But kimchi is also part of this category of side dishes called banchan. And when you go to a Korean restaurant, you're often presented with 5 or 6 different little dishes on your table at one time. And all of those foods, you know, Americans might think, wow, they're giving us free hors d'oeuvres.
Right,
but
right.
Actually, they're a critical part of a meal. And their different intense flavors help to change what the diner is eating according to their own likes.
Uh-huh. Deborah, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
Deborah Samuels is co-author of The Korean Table, From Barbecue to Bibimbap. Now, you can find the recipe for cabbage kimchi on the website splendidtable.org. We're trying something different today. Our managing producer and my co-author, Sally Swift, is on this side of the glass. What are you doing here,
Very
dear?
Very odd for me to be here, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
I am here on a mission, I have to say. You know, these days we are all looking for ways to trim our budgets, and one of the great things about that is it's a really good opportunity to sit down with friends and family and really cook. So it seems to me that you have some things to share that you often don't get to since you're always doing the interviewing. So I want to talk to you today about a real basic that I live on and you live on, frankly. I want to talk to you about pasta. And I want you to teach us how the Italians do pasta. And what I mean by that is I want you to explain the art of the sauté. It's an excellent technique.
Well, and what you know what it really is? Well, first of all, can I just say an aside here?
Mm-hmm.
Thank goodness we're over the low-carb thing.
No kidding. It's a long time coming.
Here. Okay. That said, what's interesting about this is that you create a sauce where there isn't
right.
one. So I'll give you an example. You take your pasta pot. You have salted water in there, and I use a lot of salt in the water.
Lots and lots, people.
But all that salt isn't going into the pasta, but the pasta really does end up tasting
better. But we're
better.
Talking handful.
Well,
I'm not exaggerating. But it doesn't. It tastes good.
It tastes good. And if you don't want to use salt, don't use salt. But here's the point. You've got a big sauté pan. You film it with olive oil, and you brown some onion, which is a place you start
always,
forever.
Always.
Right. And then you throw in some garlic and maybe some chili and herbs and then a couple of cans of beans.
Mm-hmm.
Now you've got a bean sauté that you could sit down and eat by itself. But...
And here comes the magic.
Here comes the magic. The way you make it into a sauce is you do something that the Italians call lengthening the sauce, which is kind of an interesting idea.
It's a lovely term.
Your pasta is almost done. It's a little firmer than you like. Before you drain it, you take a cup of that pasta water.
And it's starchy and milky colored.
Exactly. And you drain the pasta in the colander, and then you get the heat going underneath your sauté. You pour in maybe a half a cup of that water, and you simmer it in, and you scrape up any goodies from the bottom of the pan. And now
you're making a sauce. And mm-hmm. what a lot of people who don't know this trick do, they add too much fat. They add enough oil to coat the pasta. You don't need the oil.
Much lower fat.
Cheaper.
Much cleaner taste,
right.
ultimately.
And then if you want to, you can add a little more pasta water. Mm-hmm. But, of course, it thickens because it has starch in it, and it seasons because it has salt in it. I always undersalt.
Because you can adjust it later.
Yeah,
and also
can...
cheese is salty, so you're going to be adding to it at the end.
And the idea then is that you take the drained pasta. Now, here's one other trick. You always undercook the pasta slightly because you want to finish cooking it in your sauté or your sauce so that it absorbs that
flavor.
So that hot pasta goes into the pan. You have the heat at medium. You toss, and maybe you add some cheese, and you're done. By the way, for beginners, this could be as simple as olive oil, browned onion, and even use frozen vegetables.
Mm-hmm. Economical and really reasonable for those new cooks, because I think that lots of times when people start cooking, they hate the cleanup. And this, you've just eliminated a whole step. You do it all in one pan.
Yeah, and you serve right from the skillet. Mm-hmm. Well, we have got a recipe for you to test drive this technique with. It's Sicilian corkscrews with white beans. It's spicy, it's beans, and some cheese.
And it's cheap.
It's cheap.
Darn good.
And it's on the website, SplendidTable.org. Okay, time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what's an ultimate tribute to cuisine in Korea? We're going to be back in a moment with that answer, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rosetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rosetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. We're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what's an ultimate tribute to cuisine in Korea? Well, it is the Kimchi Field Museum in Seoul. Yes, an entire museum given over to the pickled and the fermented, which are truly two of the world's main food groups. In this case, it is the infamous buried-in-the-back-garden mainstay of Korean cuisine. You know, people kid about kimchi being overpowering or inedible. But when you get done touring the museum, points of view shift. The museum has a collection of ancient writings on kimchi. There are displays of the 80 different kinds of kimchi, dioramas of kimchi in Korean culture, photo ops with kimchi, and of course, there is a tasting room. Okay, so maybe not as attractive to us as a Napa Valley tasting room, but for Asian connoisseurs, tasting kimchi is to taste a great tradition of high craft.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but just call me.
The lines are open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Anything goes. Okay, let's see. We have got Aaron calling from Pittsburgh. Aaron, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn.
Hello.
So great to talk to you. I'm so excited.
Thank you. I have
a question about tahini.
Uh-huh. Okay. Sesame paste.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, I use it every once in a while to make what is kind of a highly improvised chicken shawarma.
Mm-hmm.
I take a pita and I spread a little tahini on it. And then I put some spinach, some diced cucumbers, onions, tomatoes, some chicken. I top it with a little tabbouleh, and then I wrap it up.
That sounds fabulous.
It's really good. And then I have this giant tub of tahini left over. Because you
saying
can't,
to you, take me, I'm yours. And
exactly.
What in heaven's name am I going to do with this
exactly.
thing?
And it sits in the refrigerator looking at me like, do something with me. And I thought, this is the perfect call for you. So I have, what can you do with it and how long does it keep?
Well, if you keep it in the fridge, it supposedly can keep for about 6 months or so.
Okay.
And you know the way you know if it's good or not, you either smell it or you taste it. And if it tastes off or stale, then you know you have to toss it. But otherwise,
okay.
That holds up really well. Now, tahini is used almost as often as olive oil is throughout North Africa and the Middle East, especially the Middle East. So, I mean, some of the classics, hummus. you know, pureed chickpeas, and you add olive oil, you add lemon, you could add garlic, and then you add the tahini to taste.
Okay.
And you can add a generous amount of it. Same thing with baba ganoush. Now, baba ganoush is where you take the whole eggplants, you pierce them a bit, you put them in the oven, and you roast them until they collapse.
Okay.
And then you scrape out the inside and you puree that with the tahini, with garlic, with lemon, and a little olive oil if you want. You may not want it at all.
Right. That okay. sounds really good.
But the other thing is that you can do things like take a baked potato, especially a new potato.
Okay.
You know, like a red skin. I bake them because I love how sweet they get and the texture is so moist.
Right, right.
No butter. Add tahini and put a sprinkle of lemon juice in there.
Oh, that sounds fantastic.
It is just, you'll love it. Put it over fish or lamb or poultry before you grill it. Or roast it, even better, before you roast it. And one of the things people love to do is they will mince garlic and mix that in with the tahini, add a little olive oil, grated lemon peel, and then just slather that over even vegetables, I mean slices of potato or whatever, and then roast them in the oven. You know, I do about 350 because you don't want to burn the tahini.
Right.
But,
right.
I mean, tahini tossed with lightly boiled carrots that you've marinated with a bit of vinegar and garlic, and then you toss it with the tahini and you put that out. And if you have the carrots bite-sized, you can put them on little toothpicks and everybody nibbles on them with drinks.
Great. Well, thank you so much. There's actually a waiting list of people waiting to hear what you have to say about this.
Oh, really?
Absolutely.
Oh, really? Oh, good. Okay, say hello to all of them for me.
Thank you very much.
And there'll probably be a run on tahini in Pittsburgh.
Absolutely.
Hey, Aaron, enjoy.
Thank you so much.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
You know, tahini is like miso. First of all, it lasts just about forever in the refrigerator, and you can use it in fascinating ways. You can make a salad dressing with miso, or you can make a salad dressing with tahini. And by the way, you know, anything that's a salad dressing is also a marinade. So, I mean, there you go. Okay. 800-537-5252. We've got Marie calling from Phoenix. Marie, what do you want to talk about?
Well, hi, Lynn. I wanted to talk about curing olives because most of the olives we have here in the Southwest Desert seem to be sort of small, all pit and no fruit.
Right.
But we have an olive tree on a little piece of property we purchased recently that's quite old and quite tall, and it has big, fat, black olives, and seemed worth trying to do something with.
I so envy the fact that you have a piece of property. It's like you people who have lemons growing in your backyard.
And we do.
Yes. And I live in a place where the growing season is perhaps 45 minutes. All right. The deal, as I recall, with olives, my family does this in Tuscany, not to show off. Okay. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that this takes time, but it produces something fabulous. The first thing you want to do is, now when those olives are black, they're really ripe, so you really want to be careful with them.
Mm-hmm.
You want to make sure that there's no bruised olives, there's no mushy olives, and if you want to pick them even younger than that, you could.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the green olive is a slightly underripe olive, and then as the olive ripens, it gets darker. Some turn purple, some turn black, some turn brown. Okay. Generally, what people used to do is they'd roll them up in towels and just pound them lightly. Just like the idea is you want to break the skin.
Oh.
Now, you can just do this by spreading them out on a counter and taking the tip of a knife and just going bing, 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 bing.
Mm-hmm.
Because you want to be able to permeate them. And that's what you're going to do next is you're going to put them in cold water and put them in a cold place.
Okay.
So a refrigerator, because you live in a warm area, you're going to maybe have to have them in the refrigerator.
Okay.
And you're going to leave them for about 3 weeks, but you have to change that water about twice a day.
Oh, okay.
Now, what that is doing is it's leaching out a lot of the bitterness from the olive.
Mm-hmm.
You then drain them, rinse them, and then you make a brine.
Okay.
Generally, you want... Now, this is a very old way of knowing if your brine has enough salt.
Mm-hmm.
If it's salty enough to float an egg.
Oh, okay.
So the more salt you put in, the denser the brine gets. And you can actually float an egg.
Mm-hmm.
So it's cold water And coarse salt, don't use iodized salt. Okay. Use something like, you know, kosher salt.
Right.
Or if you want to blow money, use sea salt. And the olives go into that. They go into a cool, dark place. And you wait about 3 or 4 months.
So you don't change the brine. You just put the brine in.
You put the brine in and you let them brine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, anything that turns mushy or yucky, get rid of it right away.
Right.
Check it periodically.
Oh, you know, okay.
Stir
so it's
them.
Okay. It's okay to open the jar.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And then some people even leave it open just as long as they're covered with liquid.
Mm-hmm.
You may want to have a plate on them or that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is this is now permeating them with salt.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the quote unquote cure. That's the preservation.
Okay.
Now, once you've done that, then you can remove them from the brine. Some people even soak them a little to get rid of some of the salt. But that's the point where you can flavor them.
Oh, okay.
I mean, if you want to, you could toss them with garlic, or you can toss them, a lot of people will do olive oil
mm-hmm.
and some herbs. But then again, if you've got really tasty olives, you do nothing.
Right.
And you can even store them in a light brine. But the idea here is that you want to either have them stored in brine or you want to have air circulating around them.
Mm.
And you can keep them in your refrigerator.
Okay, great.
Some people just leave them in the brine, by the way. They just leave them there and then they soak them to get rid of some of the brine when they're actually a day or so before they're going to eat them.
Uh-huh.
And also with the brine, if it throws off any scum or whatever, get that out of there.
Okay.
But in the brine, you want 3 months.
3 months.
Yeah. Some people go to 6 months.
It sounds great.
Enjoy.
Thank you.
What a privilege.
Oh, that's great.
Your
thanks,
own tree.
Thanks so much.
Hey, take care.
You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
My own olive tree. Oh, I can't tell you. That would be so fabulous. Call us, 800-537-5252. Now, we've got Brian on the phone from Washington, D.C. Brian, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I have something that may be considered a little bit of an odd question.
Sure.
Over the holidays, I'm originally down from Lower Alabama, or L.A. as we call it,
uh-huh.
and ventured over to New Orleans and discovered a place called the Absinthe Museum.
Hmm.
Yeah, well, actually, the front of it is La Maison d'Absinthe, so in the back is a museum, and it was very
right.
fascinating to find this and got me curious since it's been decriminalized, I guess you could say, in America and a lot of Europe, what it would taste like, because I've never had any. So once I got back to D.C., I decided to pop into a liquor store and get a small bottle. I don't know
mm-hmm.
if it's a jigger or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't opened it yet. But before I open it, I wanted to see if there's any sort of good noshing food or something to eat with it, like you'd have cheese with wine or chocolate with wines or
right.
any of that kind of stuff. Has there been any research done into something like this?
Well, you know, you can go, first of all, just to get everybody on the same page, absinthe is a green liqueur, very high in alcohol, that starting in the early 90s, it was called the Green Fairy. And it was thought to alter the chemicals in the brain. In so many words, one could hallucinate. Supposedly, it was very dangerous because it was made with herbs and sugar, and it was considered dangerous because it was made with something called wormwood. And it turns out, recent research has proved that there's nothing deadly about the original formula for absinthe, but people drank a lot of it. And it has an anisey kind of flavor to it. And supposedly many of them died from alcohol poisoning. So hence it's being made again. And it has so much lore about it, and tradition and glamour. It's associated with the intelligentsia. It's associated with, the great poets and that kind of thing. And it's so associated both with France, but also New Orleans, as you know. Okay, what do you eat with it? Well, you know the tradition of how it's served, right?
Right, sugar and cold water, ice cube,
right.
cold water drizzled over the top.
Right, and you pour it over the sugar cube, and then the water makes the absinthe cloudy, and it's this wonderful green-yellow. It's fabulous looking. But normally what it was served with was salty things, salted nuts, things like, maybe dried anchovies, salami, The kind of hors d'oeuvre things that the French love. There's mushrooms a la grec, which are really little button mushrooms that are marinated with orange and fennel and tomato and garlic. And then they're served on toothpicks.
Mm.
after they've sat for a day or so in that combination, and a lot of olive oil in that. But the point here is that you want to serve it with things that are going to contrast this sweet, anisey kind of taste. Mm-hmm. So think, you know, salt, fennel, fresh fennel, which goes with the anise. But if you serve fresh fennel with a little bit of an orange wedge and stick that on a pick or something like that, really delicious with it. So something that's cool, something that's fresh, something that's salty.
Wow.
And you probably wouldn't have it with the main part of the meal.
Right.
Yeah, but you're going to have a lot of fun with it.
Well, I was thinking about, believe this or not, having a combination absinthe tasting and karaoke night.
I think the karaoke will be a natural progression from the absinthe tasting. I mean, invite your most uptight friends because you'll see a whole new side of them.
Uh-huh.
Enjoy the green fairy.
I will.
Okay.
Merci.
Hey, c'est rien. Merci, monsieur. Goodbye, Brian. Absinthe, the glamour of it alone. You start reading all of the people writing in the 19th century in France and Hemingway talking about it. He said you should have three and four at a time, which explains a great deal about writer's block. Call us 800-537-5252. We now have an inaugural poet laureate. Poet Elizabeth Alexander was asked to create a poem for the Obama inauguration. Well, she read her work, Praise Song for the Day, from the same podium where the new president spoke. We have Elizabeth Alexander on the phone. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So have you recovered?
I'm recovering. It was a rather enormous experience.
What was it like up there?
Well, on the one hand, it's so unimaginable. A crowd of that size is so unimaginable. It's so surreal that I don't mean to say it wasn't scary or daunting, but on the other hand, there's no way to prepare for that. So really, it was just a moment of awe for me to look out at all of those people, to send a poem out, and to think that President Obama wanted all of those people to listen to poetry and to listen to music. That seems like a beautiful way to start what I really see as a new era.
Are your students seeing you through new eyes at this point?
I don't know about that. They're a wonderfully devoted lot to begin with. I really love my students, so I think that they are excited, and I hope feel that this is an adventure for them as well.
I'm picturing them strewing rosebuds in your path as you return.
That
to the
has
classroom.
Not yet happened, but they certainly have been full of joy and good words.
Well, you know, Elizabeth, we're on a mission. We want to get more poetry into our lives.
Excellent.
Do you have anything you could read us on food?
Absolutely. I want to read you this poem called Butter.
Perfect title.
Butter. My mother loves butter more than I do, more than anyone. She pulls chunks off the stick and eats it plain, explaining cream spun around into butter. Growing up, we ate turkey cutlets sautéed in lemon and butter, butter and cheese on green noodles, butter melting in small pools in the hearts of Yorkshire puddings, butter better than gravy staining white rice yellow. Butter glazing corn in slipping squares, butter the lava in white volcanoes of hominy grits, butter softening in a white bowl to be creamed with white sugar, butter disappearing into whipped sweet potatoes with pineapple, butter melted and curdy to pour over pancakes, butter licked off the plate with warm alaga syrup. When I picture the good old days, I am grinning greasy with my brother, having watched the tiger chase his tail and turn to butter. We are Mumbo and Jumbo's children despite historical revision, despite our parents' efforts, glowing from the inside out, 100 megawatts of butter. So there it is.
Couldn't have ever come close to doing it better myself.
I'm sure you could probably add a few more things to the catalog.
Perhaps, but not quite the way you do it. Elizabeth, thank you. I'm going to fall asleep tonight thinking about that.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Elizabeth Alexander is professor of English and African American literature at Yale University. She was the inaugural poet laureate for the inauguration of President Obama. Now, you can find information on that poem, Butter, on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us at any time. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this old Dutch proverb. Eat butter first and eat it last, and live till 100 years be past. The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media. Now, you will find information on almost everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. And there is more. Not only will you find newsletters and podcasts, you will find information on our book, How to Eat Supper. And also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. The Splendid Table is supported by the Repossessing Virtue Project. Engage with wise voices on the economic downturn from moral and ethical perspectives, and add your own voice at speakingoffaith.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Andrew Schumacher and Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.